I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hello, Simon.
Hello, Brian.
Very nice to meet you.
Very nice to meet you, Chin. Thank you very much for doing this. I really am very, very pleased that you're agreed to do this.
So, interestingly, we look very similar.
I know. It's very odd. Yeah. And, you know, we have the baldness theme. And I was reading through the diary and I was finding all these references to haircuts as well, which was very, very shocking. It's funny in relation to access thinking and, neat versus shaggy, masculine versus feminine. And you make a very interesting remark where you talk about, access thinking as a name for a continuum of possibilities between two extremes, and then what about haircuts becomes the question, and then the same which is going to bring us to hopefully to what we're going to talk about, what wants to talk about was you make a remark about empathy and you say that the usual view is that human culture begins with language. We're linguistic animals, and that's a view. But you say, and there's lots of evidence to back this up, that it starts elsewhere. Perhaps starts with other things like visual things, musical things, but it starts with empathy. And you think it starts with empathy, which is beyond language, but a precondition for it. You say. Back then,
yes. So what I would say is that it really begins with what they call theory of mind, which is the ability to understand what might be in another person's mind, and to understand that might be different from what's in your mind. I mean, this is essential for humans, that this is why we're able to communicate with each other, because we know that we don't have exactly the same picture in mind. So I can talk to the picture that I know you have, and I can slightly modify the way I describe it so that I can communicate with that picture. And this is, of course, why humans can lie. Humans can lie because they know how to create a false picture in somebody else's head. And until recently, it was thought that only humans, because it requires this thing called theory of mind. But now it turns out that some animals are capable of deceit, like certain birds are capable of misleading other birds about where they've hidden food, for instance. Mm-hmm. Certain chimps can do that as well, certain of our primate cousins. So it isn't unique to humans, but it's very, very much more highly developed in us, I think, this ability to inhabit somebody else's mind. And we can even make quite complicated ideas, like Mary knew that David was angry with Joan because she had been unkind to Jill. So there we're talking, we're sort of inhabiting a chain of four minds in a row.
Mm-hmm.
And this seems to be uniquely human, I think. And so the question is, how did we get to be like that? And are we getting better at being like that? You know, is it possible that that's one of those, a sort of human mental skill that is evolving over time?
I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of debate, say, in the history of philosophy about, you know, where morality originates, and you know, there are certain people that think it's reason and Kant, mm-hmm. and there are others, usually called moral sense theorists, who say it begins something else, with a feeling, like sympathy, mm-hmm. or empathy, mm-hmm. or benevolence. And I prefer that view of things, but the problem is how you generalize that and how you deal with situations where there's an obvious lack of empathy, or where that empathy will be used to deceive or lie or manipulate, yes. or deceive. And that's that, you know, once we introduce, you know, that the world of emotions into things like morality and politics, which is, you know, obviously there, then the capacity for deceit is obviously magnified. Does that mm-hmm. change in human behavior? I don't know. I mean, I suppose I'm not a huge fan of progress in a way. I mean, it's a nice idea. You know, it looks good on the Brazilian flag, but I think that might be the best place for it. I think there are certain capacities which human beings have in groups, which are linguistic, but they're also visual, symbolic, musical, collective, and they. I guess, and that, so, you know, the question which I guess you wanted to, you suggested, and I think is a good question, you know, why do we do art? mm-hmm. That issue, why do we do art? I mean, there are different ways of tackling that. I mean, it's, I don't know I've got a sense of what your view is, but I'd like to know what your view of that is. I mean, I've got maybe an idiosyncratic response to it, which is more like,
well,
but go on, you go first.
Okay. Well, it's quite a long story, so I won't try to tell the whole of my thoughts about that question. It is to me the most interesting question of all. For instance, to make it very specific, why do we like music? Why would we be interested in one set of noises rather than another? And not only interested in, sometimes completely obsessed by, moved to tears by, moved to rage by this set of noises made by a group of instruments rather than another set of noises made by the same group of instruments. We obviously feel very strongly about this thing that isn't figurative, it's not telling us a story in any obvious novelistic way. What is actually happening to us? So this is actually why I got interested in haircuts, because I want to be able to talk about those sorts of aesthetic choices we make, but not in relation to things like paintings or symphonies, because we don't all share those. Place, mm-hmm. But nearly everybody shares a feeling about their haircut. So I want to look at the haircut as a sort of aesthetic, a set of aesthetic decisions that everybody makes, just like they make decisions about what kind of music they like.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where this axis thing came up.
Yeah.
Because when you make a haircut decision, for instance, one axis in haircut decision might be masculine, feminine. You can have a totally feminine haircut, like a beehive, for instance. That's traditionally a totally feminine haircut. Or you can have a totally masculine one, like a sort of like what we've got, buzz cuts. And of course, playing with those gender positions and everything in between those two is interesting. You know, that's a long continuum and there's lots of places in between. So somehow when we're making a choice about our haircuts, we're making choices about where we want to be, for instance, on the masculine feminine axis, mm-hmm. for instance, on the primitive futuristic axis, on the natural contrived axis, on a whole set of axes like that. And I think, I mean, I'm making a very short circuit in this argument here, but I think that any artwork is really, as well as lots of other things, it's really a package of these propositions, these axes, mm-hmm. and it has a particular address in that nest of axes. Any artwork is a sort of particular place in of those things, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think we quite unconsciously, most of the time, or subconsciously, make decisions about those things and have strong feelings about them. You know, people say, and they mean it, I wouldn't be seen dead in that, referring yeah. to a piece of clothing or a haircut or something. Mm-hmm. So the feelings are very strong, and I think they're strong because at some level we know what those things represent. We know what a haircut means.
Yeah.
If nothing else, it means I'm like one of those kinds of people who has that kind of haircut. Mm-hmm. And you might not even be able to articulate or to take apart what that package of things is, but nonetheless, it has some meaning to you. So that's a first answer to that question of why do we get so obsessed with artworks? So I think, you know, you can apply the same kind of argument to clothes or to earrings or to songs or to sculptures or to anything else. You can always say what set of axes are being explored here.
Yeah.
It's probably not the funnest way to enjoy a piece of work, but it's a good question to ask.
Well, because my mother and my mother was a hairdresser and my sister was a hairdresser, and so, you know, I was experimented on when I was a young child relentlessly. So my baldness was a kind of revenge against them. So there could be no haircut because there was no hair. And my mother always held me personally responsible for going bald. She used to say, you know, you have such lovely hair, Simon. You have such lovely hair. What happened to it? And she used to insist it was blonde as well. I've got photographs which show it wasn't blonde, it was brown, but she insisted. So baldness is my revenge. Now, because we're improvising here, obviously, and as will be clear to the audience, we're improvising. I did this my last class for the semester on Tuesday, and I mentioned this just because it was interesting what transpired, that it's been a class called Pandemic Mysticism. It's been an odd class, taking these ideas, taking the fact that we've been in these kind of withdrawals, these kind of anchor holds, retreated from the world, and living like, you know, in this kind of monk-like or nun-like state mm-hmm. for the last year. And what is that? And that's thrown up all of these strange emotions, right? Anxiety, depression, and all of that, which are being talked about. But one thing that we've been looking at some of these texts for this semester, but the last class I wanted to do it on music, and because the sense that I've had over over COVID is that what you say about haircuts and, you know, other types of things, earrings and perfume is true, but there's a particular kind of intensity that people have experienced around music over the last year. And this class went on for nearly 3 hours, and students just picked a piece of music that meant a lot to them, and why it meant a lot to them. And the range was startling. But what bound them together was just the sense of of what this meant, how deeply this was felt, without that necessarily being able to be articulated. But there is something, I think, certainly for me, about music which is able to carry a kind of intensity which other forms of music, other forms of art, yes, they can do that, but for me, less pointedly, I guess, because I have less of a vocabulary for articulating. I don't really know what music does to me. I just know that it does it. And and then questions of taste and questions of, you know, become really important. And, you know, as we all know, but I just wondered whether that made sense to you, that the there's something characteristic, something incredibly intense about the, you know, the what do we do with art question in relationship to music in the last period of time, and how we might think about
it. I think the reason I said that question, why do we like music, is because it's so an extreme version of that mystery. You can say, why do we like novels? And there's a whole other set of reasons for liking novels, like the story, the momentum of the story, and the fascination of the characters in the story, and so on. But if you want a purely abstract form of art, music is it. You know, this is, music is where painting finally got to in the early 20th century, when people like Kandinsky started leaving out the subject, as it were. They weren't making paintings of anything, like of a painting of a scene or of a ship or of a nude or something like that. Music had been doing that for centuries. No, music never had a subject in that sense. Of course, songs do. That's a slightly special case. Then they have a narrative element in them. But music, despite the efforts of the people who write the text on classical music covers, where they try to say that here Beethoven is portraying the bubbling of a mountain stream and all that bollocks, which all of us know is not nothing to do with what's actually going on. We have to accept that music is simply about itself, really. It's about the arrangement of things in relation to each other. You know, you have opera where you sort of graft on a narrative as well, but most of us listen to opera in a language we don't understand and have no idea what it's about, and it doesn't matter. We aren't concerned with that. You don't need subtitles with music. You know, you don't have French music translated for you or Belgian music translated for you. So to me, it makes this question particularly pointed, because you can't point to any of the conventional reasons for liking an art form, of saying, oh, well, it's a good story, or those kinds of novelistic reasons that you might use with some kind of written text. So my question is, what is happening when you listen to a piece of music? What is happening to you? Again, this is quite a big subject, but I think what is happening is that you are agreeing to enter into a world with a set of internal values and a sort of internal logic to it. So I say that about an internal logic, because the logic of a 1928 blues recording, the internal logic of that is quite different from the internal logic of a symphony orchestra playing a big piece like that. But there is a logic, and as soon as you hear the first few notes, you know the kind of world of listening that you're in. You don't listen to a blues musician and say, where are the oboes? Where's the harp? Who's the conductor? You know that it's a different set of rules in each of these worlds. And as soon as you know that, you work within the terms of that world. So suddenly, certain details become very interesting, and they wouldn't be in another musical language. Certain things are missing completely. They aren't a subject at all. For instance, to take an example, in most classical music, variety is a big issue. You know, things go from the loud movement, to the quiet movement, to the sad movement, to the energetic movement. There's always that kind of motion. But then if you listen to a composer like Steve Reich or actually to quite a lot of religious music, there isn't that sort of dynamic. There's a steady state.
Yeah.
So, but in each case, when you come to them as a listener, you sort of immediately twig, oh yes, we're now under these kinds of rules. We're now in this sort of world, and I'm going to enjoy being in that world. But the important thing about that for me is understanding that what you're doing is entering an imaginary world of some kind.
Yeah.
And then seeing how you feel about it. You know, mm-hmm. suddenly, oh, I love this world. Oh, I don't like this one very much. Mm-hmm. We're picking and choosing between worlds. Now, you said something in your book that I really liked, if I can remember it. Theater is the night kitchen of democracy. Is that right?
Yeah, I did say that, yeah.
Yeah, that's a really nice sentence, I think, because it, to me, it captures this thing that I think art does. It gives you a place to try things out.
Mm-hmm.
Now, again, in novels, that in theatre and film, that's very clear how that's done. You invent a scenario, you invent characters who inhabit it, and then you see what happens to them.
Yeah.
That's a really wonderful thing to do, and it's a way that we understand a lot about the world. But for me, the more difficult question is, are we doing the same thing as that when we look at, say, a Jackson Pollock painting or a Steve Reich piece of music or something that doesn't have any narrative content? How are we, is that the same process going on? And so that's the question that I like to ask, and I like to think of ways of answering it. But I'll let you proceed for a minute.
It's fascinating. It's the theatre is the night kitchen of democracy is also, you know, it's the because I wrote that piece and other pieces. I was living in Athens and in 2019 and writing some pieces from there. And there you've got, you know, on one side of the Acropolis you have the agora and democracy and the council, the boule, and all of those institutions. Then the other side of the Acropolis, the rock, you have the, you know, what was the theatre? And theatre described as, you know, people didn't say they were going to the theatre. The Athenians didn't say that. They said they were going to musicking, right? They were going to music, right? This was kind of music, dance. That was what was going on in theatre. And often what was going on in those two places seems to be completely contradictory. You have a world of, let's say, you know, democracy, limited as it was in Athens. But, you know, they invented it. And theatre, they invented that too. And contrasting worlds, a world of, you know, kings and a kind of a mythic world which had gone at the same time as, you know, this other world of democracy which was being stage. And the relationship between the two is really hard to figure out. The music of it is, I think, is very important. And look, I wanted to also take this in a, there's some things I'd like to bring up. One is Idiot Glee, which I think is something we could do with a lot more Idiot Glee. It's a very nice concept, and the way you describe it coming from a conversation with Fripp, I think, on a subway station or something. The feeling of being glad to be alive. And I think music does that. Music makes me glad to be alive all the time. How it does that is the issue. I mean, I think the way you described it in terms of entering into worlds, accepting a kind of the logic of what, yes. But I suppose there's also, but does that capture the pathos of music and the intensity of music and the way we're transported by it? And, you know, and I also feel that, you know, Let me quote something you wrote back at you and see what you think about it now. Obviously, this is 25 years ago in the diary, but I thought it was just a very interesting remark. And you describe it as your most optimistic thought. You say, this is my most optimistic thought. The people abandon the increasingly perilous old definitions of identity, such as race, ethnicity, and class and blood, and start thinking of identity as something multiple, shifting, blurred, experimental, and adaptive. I think the philosophical underpinning for such a change is already sliding into place under the guise of pure entertainment. And that's absolutely... And it's also that and I think that music does something like that, that there is the experience of it is an experience of identity, which we seem to be still deeply attached to, but as multiple shifting, blurred, experimental, hybrid, fluid, odd, and we can, you know, and which means that we can listen to music from completely different cultures, with a deep intensity, a shared intensity. And so in many ways your most optimistic thought, but I think I feel that optimism, I think probably only in music, when I'm listening to music and talking about music and experiencing music with people, and then you see someone that you've got maybe little in common with, and then you get to talking about music, and then you find these common points of reference and these common felt intensities, and then a world opens up in a different way. So how would you, do you still feel optimistic in that way?
Yes, you said something just when we started out, actually. You said something that questioned the idea of progress, and I generally would agree with you about that. I'm not wedded to the sort of Steven Pinker idea that everything's getting better all the time.
Right.
And I have a lot of arguments with my Californian friends about this, who clearly believe that it is, despite the evidence, as far as I can see. But one thing that I do think is different, in your mind, would progress be a proper name for the generalization of empathy? For instance, I think it is significant that, when that big tsunami happened in 2005, do you remember when hundreds of thousands of people suffered, that all over the world, people started sending money to people they would never meet, never even know who this money was going to. And I thought that was really quite extraordinary. And I saw something of that kind of empathy last year as well, during the worst days of COVID. My daughter is a doctor, and I heard many stories from her about this kind of thing. And I think that is quite interesting, that we don't seem to be so chained as we used to be to family or clan or immediate connections. We have a much broader set of connections. And I'm sure that one of the reasons we do that is because we share so much art together. I'm using art in a very broad sense, meaning all sorts of pop culture and foodstuffs, and I'm not only, whenever I use the word art, I'm not just talking about high art, I'm talking about everything stylistic that people do. And I'm sure that makes us capable of starting to believe that all those other people aren't savages. You know, the way when you ask what does the name, Iglalu Sioux mean, or whatever the name of the ethnic group is, and it turns out that it always means the people. So it used to be the case that everyone thought that they were the people, so as it were, the chosen people, this little group that I happen to belong to. I think people think less and less like that now. Perhaps I'm being optimistic in believing that, but I think that there is a sense when we enjoy the art of another, nation, that we are somehow, or another people, we're somehow connecting at a level below language, lower than, deeper than language.
Mm-hmm.
We might not agree on quite a lot of things if we actually articulated them, but we at least agree that we are both of the same level of humanity to be able to enjoy this same artifact.
Mm-hmm.
Something connects us. I don't know if that's...
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I'm also, to qualify the thought about progress, it's not that... My problem with progress is that it induces forgetfulness, or it can induce the idea of history as a kind of a linear. History is a line. It's an arrow. It's going this way. And it's not.
Yeah.
It is a series of loops. It's a kind of almost like a strange piece of generative music. It's a kind of looping back and forth. And things are remembered and things are forgotten. And you know what? And then it can be quite saddening in a way that, you know, for example, in relation to the pandemic, and a question, you know, we were talking about earlier on was, you know, has the pandemic, you know, what is the point of art and philosophy in a world falling apart? Has COVID taught us anything? And we grew up in cultures seemed to be committed to remembering things like the First World War. There was a monument in every village and every time. But we forgot the Spanish flu.
Hmm?
We forgot that. We remember the First World War, and it's terrible, and it did, but it did these extraordinary things. It led to these extraordinary innovations in art and in philosophy. It led to Wittgenstein's Tractatus, Rosenzweig, Freud, Heidegger, all these things, and in poetry, Eliot's Wasteland, and whatever, all these amazing things. But we forgot the flu, and so in a sense that the last year for me has been also about not so much progress, but in the sense that there's a kind of looping back to something arcane in us. And now we think, of course, human society is defined by plague. Right? That's what happens in human societies. They're affected by pestilence. And and that's happened to us. And in that remembering of that, something kind of elemental is awoken in us, which I don't think we've figured out yet. There's fear and anxiety and sadness. There's that. There's also a real wish for pleasure, for diversion, for distraction, and it's also there is, one hopes, a creative possibility in this, right? If the plague in its terrible effects can also shake things up in a way that allows for new kinds of experimentation to appear. And that happens. I don't know.
Do you know there's a book by a writer called Walter Scheidel, who's a I don't know what nationality he is. He teaches in California. The book is called The Great Leveler.
Yeah.
And he's a historian, sort of an economic historian. And he goes through 5,000 years of history, showing that the only thing that tames inequality is war or pestilence. So, whenever there's a real breakdown of society because of war or pestilence, for a little while, things improve. Afterwards, things get more equal. For instance, the famous case is the Black Death, where for the first time ever, feudal serfs, workers, had the chance to argue about their wages because they were in demand. There weren't enough of them. So many had died in the plague. And it's a quite depressing book, because the sort of message of it is that things only ever get better after they've been really bad. Mm-hmm. So things have to get really bad to improve. And I sort of wonder if we're on that trajectory now. We're seeing the most extraordinary inequality that has ever existed in world history,
mm-hmm.
with people so unthinkably rich and lots and lots of people so unthinkably poor. And we're seeing, you know, a climate crisis. We're seeing democracy crumbling in many ways. We're right at the edge of a big collapse, it seems. And the only possible good news is that maybe after that, there'll be a revival. There'll be a new beginning, you know, like there was after the plague and like there was actually after the Second World War. You know, you had that 35, 40 year stretch after the Second World War, before neoliberalism, Thatcher and Reagan and so on. You had a period where you had some kind of working and effective socialism. The National Health Service, what an incredible idea.
Yeah.
And it was built and it worked.
Yeah. And it enabled someone like you and then someone like me to get educated, to move from one set of social circumstances to another without having to pay huge amounts. And it was, yeah, and it's gone. Yeah, I hope the question of, I mean, I was teaching Julian of Norwich a few weeks ago, and I'm teaching her book Showings, which is the first book in English by a woman that we know for sure is by a woman, which and it's extraordinary that it's not read more. But there was also, and there she is in her anchor hold in her kind of lockdown for 30 years in St. Julian's Church in Norwich, and outside is Black Death, which I think in the city of Norwich, which was the second biggest city in England at the time, I think a third of the population died. Mm-hmm. And pretty common across the whole of Britain. That led to a labour shortage, that led to the peasants' revolt, that led to the biggest, you know, insurgency and insurrectional status which Britain which England experienced until the 17th century. And I mean, you know, you to that extent the conditions are propitious, maybe they're possibly propitious. And what for me philosophy can, you know, do is that, I mean, philosophy is thinking that takes place in solitude and in conditions of pestilence a lot of the time. You've got, you know, philosophers locked up like Boethius and Socrates and many others. And in a sense, it can, that feeling of withdrawal reflection, the fact that we've been through this philosophical moment over the last year, has thrown up all sorts of feelings. And there's a tendency, there's a strong desire to kind of manically push those aside and go back to normal and have a good time and have a holiday. And that's fine. But, you know, you really wonder whether this could develop in more interesting ways. I mean, in the preface to the new edition of the diary, you ask a question, which I thought was, you know, you say even an empire cannot change biological reality. And I wonder whether it will make any difference to how we view the role of leadership in the future, not the macho braggarts, not the we make our own reality brigade, but the people who have the humility to listen to science and the humanity to care enough to act on it. Mm-hmm. I think that's well said, and I guess we'll find out. As Philip Larkin would say, we will find out. I mean,
unfortunately, I think we are finding out already, and it's kind of depressing. I was at a meeting. I'm on the board of a public institution here in England, and at the beginning of the meeting, the chairman said, "Well, we hadn't met for a while. Would everybody like to sort of give their assessment about where we are after this period of COVID and how are things doing?" And one by one, people were saying, "Oh, it's great. People are spending money like nobody's business. Everything's back up. Property prices are going up." And I was getting more and more depressed. I was thinking, Is that what it's about then? We're just going to get back on the train and act as if nothing happened. It seemed to me like the most extraordinary failure of an opportunity, actually. You know, we had an opportunity. And I really sincerely hope that people, first of all, start remembering a few things about how last year, when we were suddenly made aware of who the essential workers were, and they weren't people running hedge funds. They were people doing shitty, bad paid jobs that we hadn't paid any attention to for a very long time. And suddenly we're hanging on there, you know, admiring them and applauding them every Thursday night and so on, which we should have been doing perhaps for all the previous Thursday nights as well. So there was that, there's that. And the other thing that came up was I remember so well last year how so many people were saying, do you know what? I haven't been into a shop for 2 months and I don't mind. I haven't bought any new shoes or clothes. And actually, I'm quite enjoying this. I'm quite enjoying wearing the same things every day. And I actually like being with my family. I haven't had a chance to do this. I just hope that people don't forget that we were sort of all reborn in a funny way last
year. Have you found it more narrowly with music, in the sense in which what's been going, because in a sense the when I was rereading the diary and I've been thinking about things and thinking about the well, a couple of things really. There's the idea, in a sense, of of say generative music, which you pioneered, and back in that book, I think you talk about there's three options. There's live music, recorded music, and generative music, and and it also happens now with streaming that you let the algorithm do its magic, and a whole evening. You have to make a choice, and then and then the weird things you find yourself listening. I thought, this is pretty good, They know my taste so well, and I don't know what you think about that. And also that there's another concept which is just good to remember that you introduced, which I think is it just keeps getting lost because we just focus on individuals. We focus on heroic figures. Great figures, stars, the people we admire, which is, maybe that's just human weakness, but you say that you're against what you call the big man idea of history. Mm-hmm. You talk about not genius, but senius. And I think that's a very interesting concept, because if you look at the periods of extraordinary creativity in popular music in the last 70 years, indeed, they've all been senius moments, where certain concatenations of individuals have found themselves in a place or in a number of places, and they've found something together. And this is how punk happened, and how we know the story. And I wonder what the conditions for senius are now or have been. That really puzzles me. And then,
Well, I think one of the interesting things about last year, certainly for me, and for many people I know, is the possibility of having conversations like this. I mean, we're geographically 3,000 miles apart. We're at different times of the day. And to have arranged this conversation 3 years ago would have been incredibly complicated. Hotels, planes, all the apparatus. Well, now we can have conversations like this 3 or 4 times a day, where we're talking to people in Beijing, in Sydney, or wherever. So that to me is very interesting, that I've seen so many sort of thought coalitions come into existence in the last year, of people being able to have complicated and interesting conversations repeatedly. So bringing people together once is difficult enough with all the planes and the hotel rooms, but for them to be able to do it every week. I have one discussion group that I'm part of. It's just 4 of us, but we're in 3 different continents. every week and have a chat. This is such an incredible luxury. When could you ever do that in history before? So, you know, you have that great Xenius of ancient Greece. That was Athens, was one of the great Xenius, by the way, for the benefit of people who don't know, is whereas genius is sort of the intelligence of an individual, Xenius is the intelligence of a whole team, a whole group of people. And I think we're seeing much more of that now than we ever did before. For instance, one reason for that is because job definitions have become so blurry. Lots and lots of people have lots of different jobs. You know, they aren't really one thing. They do a bit of this and a bit of that, and they make their own melange of these things. I see that more and more with young people because it's so hard to get a job. So somebody will do a day on this place and a couple of hours over there. They're always on the phone available for that job. This is, again, sort of a hunter-gatherer style of being occupied, you know, as opposed to the agricultural style where you have your field and you go and tend it every day and look after it carefully. What I see people doing more now is moving around, finding things, putting them together, moving on, doing something else. It's so much less focused. Not all, of course, not all jobs are like that by any means, but for many people that's become, you know, I know young people who have four jobs, and each one of them would have been your job a few years ago. Now it's just one of the things they do, particularly in the arts, I think. True.
So we've all become pastoralists in a way.
Yes, that's right. I think so. I'm just wondering, there's all lots of questions here. Do you think we should?
Yeah, we should.
Have a look. Okay, I'll start at the end. Anonymous question. Would you agree that music generally is comprised of notes which are specific frequencies of sound that resonate in the human ear? We're sympathetic to these sounds. The rest of it, how we articulate sympathy with these sounds, is interpretation, which requires language. I don't know about it requiring language. I mean, I think one of the part of the magic of music is that we don't have to be able to articulate it, how we feel about it. In fact, it's probably the experiences that we feel most strongly about are the ones that we can't articulate about, where something has happened to us beyond language. Something, things that happen beyond language feel very deep. They feel like they come from a very deep place in us. And sometimes the articulating of them slightly confines them, actually. So I the implication of your question is that language is an essential part of the mix. You're probably saying, no, I didn't mean that. Well, that's what I understood.
I think it's with me, it's very much the you know, because I've, you know, spent, I write books and I was, you know, taught to think in writing, and I've developed that over the years. And I, in a sense, I can say, well, that's very nice, but that's not really what I care about. What I care about is music. That's what I care about, which I can't talk about. I can talk about it in rough approximative ways, but I can't express why certain things matter so intensely to me. You know, when Nietzsche says, you know, without music life would be an error, just think, well, that's right, yeah, it would be an error. And but there are people who don't feel as strongly about music, and I can't help judging them at that point in some horrible way. Yeah, so it's a kind of
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. United Healthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I knew somebody, actually. Very nice person. I enjoyed the company of very much. And he once said to me, I just don't like music.
Right.
I said, well, any music. He said, yeah, I just don't like it. I don't like listening to it. And that seemed to me so unusual. It made me realize how much I assume that music is a key part of everyone's life. It wasn't in his case. Can I read another question here?
Yeah, questions too. Yeah. Go on.
This is Jamie Denham asking on art and morality. Doesn't a concentration camp also work by a system of internal rules, associations? Isn't music and abstract art aiming for the thing in itself, by definition, amoral? The thing in itself is one of those philosophical phrases, and the Ding an sich, or however they say it in German. Is it amoral? That's a very difficult question. Is it possible for anything that humans do to be amoral? Isn't our morality informing everything that we do? What would be a philosophical view of that?
Yeah, it's a very difficult question. I mean, it's, you know, because you actually, in the diary, you say, you know, it doesn't a concentration camp also work by system internal rules and associate? Yes, it does. And, my view is informed by, I was very pleased to see Raoul Peck exterminate all the brute, very brutal documentary series, but it picks up from the work of Sven Lindqvist, who's someone who I think is a very, very important thinker, who shows the basically the continuity of Western civilization is a continuity of extermination, and we just get better and better at killing people, and the concentration camp is a technology for that, and it begins in Cuba, South Africa, and then it's extended by the Germans into Poland, and does that mean there can be no poetry after Auschwitz? No. That's where, you know, Adorno is wrong. No, it's not a precondition for it, but it doesn't disqualify it. And it's and then the question of whether it's isn't music a thing in itself and by definition amoral? I don't know. I mean, it depends. It really depends on what metaphysics you're coming to. There's a view which you can find in, say, one of my favorite poets is Wallace Stevens. One of his last poems called Not Ideas About the Thing, But the Thing Itself. And his thesis, roughly, is that poetry is ideas about the thing. It's not the thing itself. And so he says, there's a sun, there's a pond. And that's the thing in itself. And I can't say that. That's one view. Another view, another writer who I'm very much admire, so Annie Dillard, an American writer, she takes the view which is in a sense that the thing in itself in an artwork, the thing in itself is alive. It becomes, you have to an artistic world has to be in a sense animistic, right? We have to inhabit an animistic world where these are things in themselves and they have agency and they're connected to us. And I think if we ask ourselves the question about music, well, coldly, we could divide it up into different boxes. But when we're experiencing a piece of music, then it's not, it's alive. So therefore, and it's also not amoral. It's, it's part of our moral view, that not in a kind of a moralistic view, but it's just kind of the sets of habits and practices and ways of thinking that constitute being in a world, in my humble opinion.
Yeah, well, not that humble. That's a good opinion. One thing I wanted to ask you, one of the interesting things about art over the last 50 years or so is that very often it's been complete outsiders who've revolutionized areas of artistic behavior. So they aren't necessarily people who came up through the academy and studied this and that and so on and got their degrees and so on. I mean, you see it in pop music in particular, where band like the Velvet Underground, who had a drummer who'd never played drums before and, you know, who on paper should not have been a successful band. They were a great band, one of the great innovating bands. So in art, I think we're quite used to the idea now that sometimes it's complete outsiders who will change the direction of the art form. They'll do something that nobody within the so-called academy would have done. But is the same thing true in philosophy? Who makes philosophy now? I mean, of course, I know there are professional philosophers who do it, but are there outsiders, people who come up with an idea which makes you think, wow, that's a thought that I hadn't ever had before. That's a way of thinking. I don't know who those people might be, but
I think that I think what's happened is that, and if I talk about my time as a student, it makes to you know, the students I have now, it sounds very, very odd, because I mean, the people I was taught by were weirdos. They were mm-hmm. weirdos. They were freaks. They were odd. They did odd things. They drank a lot, and they found a refuge in universities. University of Essex, where I was at in Colchester, was a kind of a camp where there was these things could be thought. Universities have become increasingly bureaucratized, boring,
yeah. And art schools too.
Art schools had that too. So someone, I think you mentioned this in the book, but someone like Goldsmith at a certain point had that kind of genius energy. It had something was going on there. It was something between teachers, students, the pop scene, the Bond Street galleries, and things emerged. And in philosophy, it was possible to do that kind of work in academic structures. It's harder to do that. One is not invited to do that. So someone that you mention, who is a kind of I wouldn't say hero, but someone I admire, although I criticized, I admire more and more since he left us, is like Richard Rorty.
Favorite philosopher.
Rorty was you know, an academic, you know, in philosophy at Princeton, you know, in a serious proper, but he left. He had to, and he ended up, you know, as a professor of humanities, and he found that philosophy is very much structured as a guild, a kind of medieval guild with masters and apprentices, and that can enable a certain kind of training at certain moments, but it can also be stultifying and dull. And I think we're more in the stultifying and dull moment now. There's still good people out there, but academia has become a place where it's just harder and harder to say really interesting things for reasons that often quite bewilder me.
Well, I have to say that Rorty was a very big figure in my life. He was the first philosopher, contemporary philosopher, that I read where I thought, this is talking about something that I want to know about. I'd tried to read, you know, Carnap and all of those analytical philosophers, and I just thought, I'm not interested in what this is about, actually. I don't even care what they think about this. Whereas when Rorty came along, something different happened. But the people now that I'm finding are sort of my philosophers. The people I'm reading for those kinds of thoughts are, for instance, feminist writers who came on board to fight a particular battle about feminism, and it turned out that they had to rethink a lot of other things to do that. Mm-hmm. And in that rethinking, they, and similarly, you know, with the, it's the rethinking, having to sort out the rest in order to sort out one bit. When people do that, it takes them through those thoughts in a way that doesn't happen to an academic study of philosophy, where you're sort of thinking about what other philosophers have said and reinterpreting that, rejigging it, you know. It's when people actually start to engage with the real world that they start to come up with really fresh thoughts. How do we think about this aspect of the world now? And for me, that was very important with Rorty, because the first book by him that I read was a great book called Contingency, Irony and Solidarity.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, he talks at some length about 1984, the book 1984. It was a big breakthrough to me to understand something that we were talking about right at the beginning, that empathy can be used to hurt people as well.
Yes.
Empathy isn't just this wonderful kind of balm that you cast onto people and everyone behaves better. People sometimes use their sense of empathy, that's to say their understanding of what's in somebody else's mind, to hurt them or to defeat them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So that was very important. But the philosophers now that I'm reading, a lot of the people who are writing books about the environment,
yeah,
and about how we should think about our relationship to the future. I'm reading a fantastic book at the moment, which I've got here, and I'm going to hold it up so that
good.
The audience can see it. Have you heard of this?
No, I haven't. No, I'll get it.
It's an amazing, amazing, amazing book. It's The Ministry for the Future by Kim Stanley Robinson. So he's basically a, I'll hold it up again in case people want to write down what they, I'm not paid to do this, by the way. It's just such a thoughtful book. It's so full of ideas. And one of the, really the ideas are about how do we value the future and what are we going to do about it? You know, we're currently destroying it at a fast rate. Do we really think that there aren't going to be consequences for this? Do we really not care about our grandchildren, for instance? Do we not think about the world that they're going to be in?
Yeah.
So this book is it's a novel. It's a sci-fi novel, I guess you'd say, but really it's a work of philosophy, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't read it without thinking about those things that philosophers think about.
Mm-hmm.
You know, can we affect the future, for instance? Is there a moral position about affecting the future? How do we discount the future and all these sorts of things?
Yeah. You know, back to Rorty, I mean, the aversion, I mean, yeah, the discussion of Orwell in Contingency, Irony, Solidarity, I mean, the idea that what makes a liberal, as he would put it, is an aversion to cruelty. It's as simple as that.
Yeah.
Yes. Ironists about deep matters, we just don't know. And liberals, a liberal just means someone who thinks cruelty is the worst thing that there is and it has to be avoided. We have to be nice and don't be scared, as Dave Chappelle would say. And it's the philosophy, in the English speaking world has largely ended up as a kind of technically sharpened common sense. There's some very, very clever people doing very, very, very little in terms of, and that's the way you're taught to do things. Because the option I've always taken is just throwing shit at the wall and, you know, see what happens. And then And some of it sticks and some of it runs down into little piles at the bottom of the wall. And that's fine. But Rorty had also been that rarest of qualities, which is prose style. He wrote incredibly well. So he's someone that's been, very much forgotten in mainstream philosophy, and the kind of the pragmatism that he adopted is has been forgotten too, which is a real pity because it might just be right. I mean, the thinker that I feel very close to these days is William James, and William James's late work, which is a sensibility which informs Rorty very, very deeply. And I guess I want to get this in,
I just interrupt you for a minute because I blew the fuses in this studio, so I don't have any power in here. So no, it's not getting dark. My computer is running out of power, but if I just walk across the garden here into another room, so there'll be a brief scenic interlude where people can look at that's where I am. That's my little house. Okay, that's all your scenic interlude. And now we're going across to the other house. Isn't this nice little break? There's the little studio I'm sitting in. Okay. Because then I can, over here, I can plug in, you see.
Right.
Going through the kitchen.
Going on a walk with you.
Sorry about this, but otherwise I'm just going to suddenly cut out, and then that will be very rude. Okay, just let me get my...
That's great.
Okay, there we are. I'm back in action.
Looked a little East Anglian out there, I must say.
Yes. Yeah, you know East Anglia, don't you?
I do, yeah. I miss it very much. I miss the Suffolk coast. I miss places like Orford and Aldborough and even Thorpe Ness and strange places like that. I love the kind of raggedy, salty, you know, stubbly kind of bushes you get on the Suffolk coast I miss that. I've not seen it for a long time.
Sorry, I interrupted you in, you were talking about Rorty and I interrupted you.
I was going to ask you a question, which is the following, which would be the relationship between, I mean, pragmatism and music as you understand it, and thinking about that in relationship to, I think this will make, I hope this will make sense, in relationship to the way you think about complexity theory. Mm-hmm. And I haven't really realized this until I was rereading it on Tuesday, that complexity theory for you is that they're taking certain simple structures, say musical structures, you know, from discrete music to forward to reflection, all those simple structures, and then allowing a kind of concatenation of simplicities to emerge into a new musical form. And that is not something, that's not, you know, a thing in itself, kind of metaphysics. You're that's a pragmatic sensibility, it seems to me, that composition.
Yeah, well, there are two reasons for it. One, I'm very attracted by economy, by the idea that you can make things that feel magical from very simple materials. I'm not impressed when people make complicated things from complicated materials. It seems to me quite obvious that's what you'd get. But I am impressed when I see something where it's very easy to see what's used. For instance, like a Mondrian painting.
Yeah.
You know, a Mondrian picture is incredibly simple, but for some reason it works. It's very powerful. To me, anyway. And ever since I was young, I was fascinated by that. It seemed to me like the best kind of magic, because that's what magic is. You know, the conjurer shows you the cards, and you can see what's in his hand. You know what a pack of cards is, and something unexpected happens. I always wanted that thrill from art, that that. So I always wanted it to be kind of obvious to a listener what was going on. There's no sort of tricks. There's no concealed bits. This is all it is, and yet for some reason it works. And the other thing, of course, is that I didn't have many other ways of making music available to me. You know, I'm not a player in the sense of I can't sit down at a piano and come up with a piece of music. Mm-hmm. So the tools I developed are tools for somebody who can't do those things but can do something else. But
which turn out to be, you know, I was going to say better tools, because, you know, it's, you know, in a sense, where are we with virtuoso musicianship? I think it's quite hard to tell. I was thinking when I was thinking about this over the last week, and I was stumbling back through things, and I was, for some reason, I went back to Gavin Bryars, Jesus Blood.
Fantastic piece.
Yeah, and just how, and the simplicity of that. There's nothing, you know, it's mm-hmm. obvious. The elements are completely obvious what the elements are. There mm-hmm. are three and some recurring motifs. And so yeah, here it is, you know, and yet it's able to, there's magic there. There's something strange. And yes. And I find No, I was going to say, if I look at the flow chart, thinking back, I remember back to my, you know, vinyl copy of Discrete Music, which I bought when it came out, and the flow chart on the back cover, you know, where you say, this is what I did, mm-hmm. looks like it's like a cybernetics diagram. And you think, well, okay, good. That's brilliant. I don't really understand that, but I see what you're doing. But it doesn't. The magical quality of that, certainly for someone as a listener like me, I mean, why I would go back to that over and over again, not for reasons of familiarity, but for reasons of, I don't know, something felt there, which is so the system which generates this and the simplicity of that, and here are the elements, but then. The effect, the emotional effect, is something else, which I guess that's the magic, right?
I saw something really nice in the supermarket the other day. It was a new kind of biscuit, sort of a cracker type thing called Fro, F-R-O. And they're really delicious. I tried them. They're really delicious. And the great thing is they put a recipe for how to make them yourself on the side of the packet. I thought that only Scandinavians would do that. They're from Denmark. I thought, what a brilliant thing to do, to say, okay, these are great, you like them, you can make some yourself. That's so generous, isn't it? And it really made me a lifelong fan of that company. I'm going to live only on Froze in the end, because I thought, why doesn't everybody do that? Say, this is how you do it.
Ministry for the Future and Froze. These are the two things I'm going to go out and buy immediately. I wonder if I can get them here. We're past our.
We better finish, because we should probably have dinner or lunch soon. But
yes, and thank you to the listeners and auditors and the people out there in. And I'm sorry we didn't get to a lot of your questions, but if you'd like to email me or whatever, just I'll try and answer them. And thank you, Brian, really.
Thank you, Simon. It was very nice to meet you, and I enjoyed having a chat with you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye, everybody.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.